Hello, my name is Nigel Green and I'm going to host this podcast, and I'd like to introduce you to our guests, who are Margaret Whitehead and Dean Dudley. Margaret trained to teach physical education and taught in schools and lectured at universities. Her principal study has been in philosophy, and Margaret has worked tirelessly to develop and promote the concept of physical literacy over the last 30 years. Margaret guided the establishment of the International Physical Literacy Association and is currently president. She is a visiting professor at the University of Bedfordshire and author of two seminal texts, the first in 2010, Physical Literacy Throughout the Life Course, and more recently, Physical Literacy Across the World, which came out in 2019. Dean Dudley is a senior lecturer and researcher of health and physical education at Macquarie University in Australia. He is also an adjunct senior fellow of the University of the South Pacific and an honorary associate professor of the University of Queensland. Dean is an expert consultant for UNESCO and has published over 70 peer-reviewed publications. He currently serves on the editorial board of the BMC Public Health and is a guest editor of the Journal of Teaching in Physical Education, as well as being UNESCO's Educational Journal Prospects. The intention of this podcast is to reflect on where the concept of physical literacy originated and why it is gaining traction worldwide. The speakers will share briefly what physical literacy is and how the concept is influencing change amongst individuals, practitioners, and policymakers worldwide. The term physical literacy has been referred to in literature since at least 1927. Physical literacy has been used to refer to fitness, health, mastery of physical skills, communicating through movement, play, and personal development. But over the last 40 years, the term has developed into a concept. So first of all, Margaret, as you developed the modern interpretation of physical literacy, could you explain the origins of physical literacy?
Yes, certainly. It's a prime example of theory and practice working together. I have a fascination in monism, that's the holistic nature of the individual, and I was studying that in philosophy, existentialism and phenomenology, and reading about the importance of respecting our embodied state as a human. At the same time, I was working in schools and universities and was considerably disheartened about the nature of the practice, which we can talk about, and also the fact that people were not continuing with physical activity through life. So this was a dilemma. I read philosophically how valuable it is to respect our embodied nature. At the same time, I see that there's very little exercise taking part in physical activity. And so I picked up the physical literacy concept as representing where the practice and the theory meet.
Okay. And Dean, I know you met Margaret in Paris, as we've just discussed, but where did you first come across the concept of physical literacy, and perhaps what inspired you to look at it more deeply and obviously work with it over the a number of years?
Margaret and I first met in 2012 when we were consulting on the Quality Physical Education Guidelines for policymakers for UNESCO. Prior to that, I had started reading some of Margaret's work just out of interest. I was a PhD student prior to 2012, and I was teaching in schools. And the reason I undertook graduate study was many of the reasons that Margaret just explained. I became incredibly frustrated with the practice that I was seeing, not only in myself, but my colleagues, and the theories that we were using to justify them, or lack thereof. So I took an early interest in Margaret's work, and when we were working on the guidelines, the concept kept emanating, and we were coupling it very closely to how we defined a quality physical education experience. And I think what from that meeting, that 2012 meeting, it really prompted me to go and spend more time researching not just what Margaret had written, but also other forms of literacy. And it was interesting at the time, because we had a national curriculum debate occurring in Australia, and I was a strong advocate for physical literacy to be one of the propositions of that curriculum. And it was constantly torpedoed by external people within the Australian physical education community. And that just rolled me up even more to actually go and have a look at, well, how can we make a case for this really important concept that Margaret had tapped into, and make it resonate with a broader range of stakeholders in the educative space. So I suppose most people who have read my work, I went back and tracked how literacy and other forms of literacy, whether it be numeracy, had evolved in the literature. And I've drawn out my interpretations in congruence with what Margaret speaks about, against the broader backdrop of literacies.
Thanks, Dean. And I think there's key similarities there with the frustration of the quality of experiences, and that's probably not just in school, but in coaching situations and opportunities for all individuals throughout their life, and the understanding of the impact that a physical literacy focus could have on the holistic development of individuals. And I think you've both sort of shared that. I think we'll come back to the actual literacy bit a little bit later on, Dean, because it does fit in. So Margaret, we're aware that physical literacy is gaining significant interest and traction around the world, certainly with academics, with practitioners and policymakers. So why do you think that is the case?
I think that they have come to realise that there is tremendous benefit in taking our embodied condition seriously, because it affects all elements of the person. I think they can see that there is tremendous value in capitalising on our embodied potential for mental health, for physical health, social health, etc., that it has a real value. And this is brought out by the rising mental health issues, the rising obesity issues. And I think there is a realization that we need to look at the individual now as a whole in order to help to live a flourishing life. It's not an optional add-on. It's actually something which we really, really need to have as part of our life pattern of activities. We need it because we are embodied.
Okay, so that holistic well-being is clearly important in the current situation. And Dean, I know you've done a lot of work with UNESCO and other organisations around the world. Would you say that focus on holistic well-being has been a clear focus from those organisations' points of view?
Without a doubt, the holistic nature is, I think, I have yet to engage in a conversation with a scholar or a practitioner who didn't buy into that argument. I think the impetus behind it is slightly different. And this is what I would argue, is we've had 40 years of research in physical activity, and 40 plus years, but really in light of the growing NCD burden that now the developing world, not just the developed world, faces. And what we've learned is that, you know, if you only tackle this, if you only tackle declining rates of physical activity through a motivational lens, yes, you get an answer, but you don't get the whole answer. If you only tackle it from a movement or a movement development perspective, do you get some impact? Of course you do, but it's not the whole answer. If you only tackle it from a mental health perspective, or if you only tackle it from a cognitive perspective, it doesn't matter which way you slice this, everybody's got some skin in this game intellectually. And everybody, every discipline that's been interested in human movement in some facet or another, whether they come from the biological sciences or the sociological sciences or history or education, all of them have some skin in this game, and all of them say they've got a voice. Where I think what Margaret tapped into, and I'm not even sure whether it was a conscious thing, but it is rather a stroke of brilliance, is that it's the interplay of all these fields of knowledge in the moment. And when you get that interplay, and when you get that respect, and you get that mutual understanding of the contributions that all these aspects of, and Margaret uses the word embodiment, I'll call it interdisciplinary, from a in a more scientific perspective, is that we actually see the gains and the changes that every sector has tried to promise individually but has seldom delivered. And I think why it's resonating with policymakers and why it's resonating at that level is because I think that's what they've realized. They've invested in silos for so long.
I mean, I'm delighted that you said that, because whatever physical literacy has done, in many, many cases, it has made people reflect and think and ask questions of why are we doing it this way? Why are we doing it? Why isn't it working? And I'm sure that you've read in things that I've written that over a very long period of time, it seemed to me that we were, you know, for example, quite good at drilling skills. We were quite good at passing that on. But there didn't seem to be the excitement and the motivation. As they left a lesson, there wasn't a feeling as, oh, I want to come back and do more. You know, it was a bit of, you've got to do this and then you can have fun playing a game, which is a great pity. And so why I put motivation right at the top of my list is we're not very good somehow in our own medium of enabling people to develop their self-esteem and their self-respect through physical activity in such a way that they want to do more. If they feel they're going to be embarrassed or humiliated, they're not going to go and do it anymore except what they've got to do in school. There's got to be a positive feedback. I've talked about, you know, meaningful experiences, which I've worked on a bit. You know, they have to have really purposeful and engaging activities, and also relevant and rewarding. We've got to look a bit further than just what we're teaching, but the effect we're having on those who are in our classes. We've got to think not just we are teaching hockey or wall climbing or something, but what's the nature of the challenge? What's the nature of the feedback? What's the nature of the future involvement? Can they take responsibility? Are they developing their own persona?
I think dissidence or cognitive dissidence is a very powerful motivator of learning, and what I mean by that for people is when we can no longer balance our accepted understanding of the world or our accepted wisdom. So why a state of dissonance is so powerful. And I think physical literacy forces us to stay almost in a perpetual state of dissonance, because there is no end point any more than there's no vacuum where it doesn't exist. It's always there. We're always moving up and through a spectrum of whatever the context throws at us, or whatever the situation throws at us. How we respond to that is really the manifestation of physical literacy in my mind.
Margaret, you've your last book looked at physical literacy around the world, and this suggested the spread to many countries. So could you just sort of share what's happening in some of those countries with us?
Well, it'll have to be very, very brief. And it's quite an interesting story. If you do read the part two of the 2019 book, there were eight countries who very kindly agreed to share what was going on in their country. And I think we've got contacts with most continents. I think we are worldwide. And it has been interesting that in some cases it has been led by a particular individual or a particular interest, so that you've got Sport Wales and Sport New Zealand who have picked it up and have developed it, policies within their organisations. They have argued with or put their case to curriculum planners. So that has gone in that direction, probably into education. Then we've got Scotland, and working within a deprived area, the gentleman who is interested felt that there was no line to be drawn between diet and physical activity. And so he has developed the concept as food and physical literacy, because he felt that they were very, very close. I think that Australia clearly have been very meticulous and methodical, and a lot of reasoning and planning and looking at development, etc. That's been taken on possibly the most academic level, I think. I think there's a more countrywide interest in that. We've had an individual in India, and a significant individual who has been able to capture the imagination of the whole country of all age. And so he has managed to introduce physical activity successfully with a variety of people. And very often, where they're going back to what you were saying earlier, Nigel, very often the motivation for support at government level has been what we've been talking about, which is the problem of participation, the problem of obesity, etc. I think they realise that they do have to act and do something.
So different countries, from your experience, Margaret, different countries have responded differently to the concept, and it's worked in different ways. And I know, Dean, obviously you've had a lot of experience, certainly links with Canada, as well as obviously you work in Australia. But more recently, your involvement in the Erasmus project in Europe. What changes have you seen within Europe, perhaps, as part of this project in relation to the development of physical literacy?
I suppose the most significant part of the Erasmus project is the language barrier. So last time I checked, I think we're actually trying... The word literacy is derived from its current version, you know, it's an English word. So we're working with a number of countries. In some of those countries, the word literacy has no meaning. It there's no direct translation of it. So what I'm really fascinated about the Erasmus project is the melding of minds around the concept. So regardless of what we call it, there are things that we have bought into as a group. I mean, we argue over semantics, I think, but when we talk about is it lifelong, is everybody capable of developing and maturing a physical? Yes, they are. Is this a quality that changes over time depending on where you are in your life course? Absolutely. Is it more than just, you know, physical performance? Absolutely. And when we talk about things like, we talk about motivation and we talk about cognition and we talk about affect and sociability, and these are all ideas that are being sucked up by this concept and being seen as equally legitimate in the conversation. And that's amazing, because what that signifies is that there, and the stakeholders too at Erasmus are quite diverse. You're not dealing solely with educators. You're dealing with sport, and you're dealing with public health, and you're dealing with fitness, and which is, you know, in my 2017 paper was really, the critical considerations paper was really saying, this is a call to arms from all sectors. Here's a unique opportunity in history for all the vested parties to have a common dialogue, to share a common language. And in doing so, I think the Erasmus project is a real first test of that, because it is multilingual. It's not even bilingual. I mean, I've worked with the New Zealanders on their project, and, you know, we're doing translations into Maori, working out of Fiji and the Pacific Islands. And yes, we're dealing with a number of languages there, but there's a commonality there, still underpinned by English. The Erasmus project is fascinating, because you're not even dealing with languages from a common origin. So we're dealing with Germanic and Scandinavian and even Cyrillic derived languages. It's great to see that this human experience is shared regardless of the cultural or language backgrounds that you've drawn from.
I think the legitimization of the physical literacy is quite an important point, because talking to some Americans the other day, they said how the status of physical education had gone down in the country, and therefore they found physical literacy, and because it was literacy, it gave it that credibility, and literally overnight they changed to physical literacy instead of physical education, and the subject gained more status. But I also think the points you made earlier, Dean, about the language, especially in Europe, and the interpretations of terms and terminology, makes it actually quite a complex concept for people to understand and have a common understanding about. So what I'd like to do is to just move on from that. Dean, you mentioned a few of the key principles, and I'm sure Margaret would pick up on those, the individual, the life course, etc. So, Margaret, what would you say are the key characteristics or principles associated to physical literacy?
Well, I came to thinking about this because there are now many, many definitions of physical literacy, which are not helpful in some ways. And I have been challenged, really, to rationalize, accept or not accept these different definitions. And the first thing that I had to realize was that the definition had to be acceptable within the context of the philosophy, the traditions and everything like that. And so simply because, and the use of wording, I mean, I don't especially like the American desire, but okay, if you want to call it desire, in England we wouldn't have a spiritual aspect, which they have in New Zealand. So when you look round at the world, there are many different descriptions with everything. So I reflected that I believe the most important two or three things. One is that the individual is treated as a whole, must be treated, in my view, should be treated as a whole if you want to foster this positive disposition to taking part. Secondly, the individual must be treated as an individual, somebody who is on their own personal, we call it the personal journey. So you are catering for a whole person who is unique. And that has quite a lot of follow through for teaching and planning and what do you put in the playground and how many swimming pools do you build and all this sort of thing. So it's the individual. And then I know that Dean doesn't necessarily agree with me, but I do think that the motivation has to come up, and using charting progress as a motivational tool. I think we believe that if we occupy the youngsters doing a physical activity, then they'll enjoy it, it'll be fun, whatever that means, and they'll go on doing it. And I think there's more to the interface between the teacher and the learner to make it, help them to be motivated. And unless they're motivated, we're going nowhere. What's the matter? Why aren't people doing it? Because they feel they're not good enough. They'll never be a, you know, a Serena Williams. And they get the picture. It's either for them. Oh, no, I don't do PE. I don't do sport. I don't do movement. So those are my three. They are holistic, unique, and really working hard to enable everyone to develop their persona, their self-esteem, through the participation in wide range of physical activities.
And Dean, I think you more or less said that yourself initially. Do you think the similar key principles have come through the Erasmus project in the same way, or are there any sort of subtle differences, would you say?
So this is probably where Margaret and I would differ just slightly. So if you asked me what the key principles of physical literacy are, they're actually the same key principles of what we should define any literacy. And I don't think that necessarily they are dependent on another. In other words, I don't think a teacher or a coach actually is a fundamental critical attribute of the equation. So here are the four things I would say. Physical literacy is about the acquisition of autonomous skills. All right. So no, I didn't say fundamental. I said autonomous skills. And what they are movement sequences, competencies, compounds, however you want to define it, that we execute or we do based upon the situation or problem we're confronted with. So they're not dependent on a sport or an activity. They're dependent upon the context in which we're required to move. The second one I would say is that the execution of those skills are largely dependent on the context. They're applied, practiced, and situated. To be able to do one thing in one context doesn't necessarily mean it automatically transfers to another. And to do that requires a tremendous amount of practice, and it requires challenge, and it requires meaning. The third thing I would say is that it is a journey and it is non-linear. So this is not something you just grow over time because you age. You don't become more literate. And your literacy, or your physical literacy in this regard, is no more valuable at the age of 2 than it is at the age of 82. It is just different. And because those applied autonomous skills in context have been practiced, the needs for them change as we go through our life course and our life journey. The fourth thing I would say is that a literacy really has to empower people. And I think this is where Margaret and I would agree. Now, when I say empowerment, I mean that literacies, and physical literacy can do this too, can write a social wrong, so to speak. So when we think about physical literacy, they should help one overcome barriers that are not of their own doing. So when society or infrastructure or communities or relationships put up barriers, or stereotypes put up barriers for one to be able to be physically active, to participate, to be motivated, to enjoy, a literacy is really a way in which it empowers an individual to overcome those barriers.
Yeah, I understand. I hear what you say. I believe we have multiple potentials as humans, embodied humans, and whether it's singing or acting or gardening or social work, we have a wide range of potentials which enable us to flourish, to affect other people. And my view is that the more we can capitalize on our capabilities, Nussbaum, etc., and our potential, the more fulfilled we shall be, the more we shall make a positive contribution to the community, and the more we shall be enriched by what we do. So what I would like to see, and I don't think we're a million miles away, but we're coming at it from a different direction, is the feedback. I mean, existentialism says the more you put into a relationship, the more you'll get out of it. And existentialism says that you become the person you are because of the interaction that you had. So if you've had a rich array of interactions, then you carry those with you in a sense. And this is where I'm... The trouble with me, I suppose, is that I came from existentialism and phenomenology, and they talk an awful lot about interaction and communication and creating ourselves. And I'm comfortable at the moment, I could change, with the notion of literacy as being a way, physical literacy if you like, a way of interaction with the world around us, capitalising on our own potential and being a positive force in our own lives and in other people's lives. So because of the existentialism and the existentialist practices, I feel that literacy is about interaction, it's about communication, and therefore it's about enriching the person.
If you had a magic wand and you could look 10 years into the future, what would you like to see, or how would you like to see physical literacy impacting on individuals, practitioners and policymakers? That's quite a big question. So I might just give you a few seconds to think about it.
I think that without any doubt, surely, given my current perception of the definition, it would be that the majority of people were participating in some form of physical activity throughout their life, as is reasonable to expect. So I would put that one first. What would you put next, Dean?
For me, this whole notion is around sustainable living. The generation, the whole impetus behind physical literacy, whether people recognise it or not, in my mind, is that the planet has to become more sustainable. The generation following us, Margaret, will need to live with a lower carbon footprint, will have to have a lower burden on the economy in terms of healthcare. They will have to live far more sustainable lives. The only way they're going to be able to do that is to really understand where they fit within the larger biosphere. They're no better, they're no worse. They're part of a large, constantly evolving, constantly interacting ecosystem and biosphere. If they don't understand, and if we don't teach them that that they all matter, everyone matters, right? And it's not whether they play football for Juventus or Chelsea, and it's not about whether they compete at the Olympics, but that it's every man, woman, child lives a sustainable, meaningful life. And the meaning's important, right? Because you can't sell sustainable living if it's not personally meaningful. You can't convince people to walk rather than drive, right? You can't convince people to play when it's easier to hop on the internet, right? So in terms of, you say 10 years, I'm thinking, if we don't have this right, or at least on a path before 2050, I'm scared it's going to be too late. And I know that sounds dire, and I've probably extended the humble work that people have been doing in this space around activity and about better coaching practices, but it's all part of a larger cog.
If you're putting that forward, then Nigel talked about practitioners and about people who are the decision makers in government, then it follows from what you've said that it is the responsibility of the teacher to so empower the youngsters to continue with physical activity, to be self-sustaining. And it does also require the decision makers to provide the wide range of context for different forms of physical activity, so that there is space, there is money, there's accessibility for this to happen.
I'd like to thank you both. I think this has been a really interesting discussion, and I'm sure we could have gone on significantly longer for each one of those aspects and into far more detail. How we're actually going to get 3-5 minutes out of that, I don't know. But I think it was a very rich discussion. And as I say, we probably could have sat here all day and it would have been fascinating. So thanks to both Dean and Margaret for that.